Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, a recap of the Air Force Association's first annual Aerospace Warfare Symposium and the key messages from service leaders. But first, joining me is my good friend, Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, the independent Washington research firm, with a look ahead at the weekend, whatever else is on his mind. Byron, thanks very much for joining us and hope you had a great weekend.
I did. I got some skiing in.
That's absolutely fantastic. Here it was raining, so I'm glad that at least the weather where you are was somewhat more conducive to winter fun. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Byron, you issued your week ahead as well as your March scorecard. Let's start with the week ahead. What's on your radar?
Well, first, you know, on the congressional calendar, we've got the March 4th Senate Armed Services Committee confirmation hearing for Colin Call to be Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And then at Brookings on March 5th, House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith is going to be speaking. So it'll be interesting to hear kind of what's on his mind, kind of, you know, priorities as we start the march into the FY22 budget. There's also, I just call out on March 5th, a Hudson Institute event on competing with China through budget agility. It's going to key off or pivot off a paper that was released last week that I commend people read, just about how long acquisition cycles has become and being able to shorten these can really get us on a sounder footing in the competition with China.
And it was Dan Patt of Hudson Institute and Bill Greenwalt of AEI, and Bill joined us last week and we discussed the report on the day it came out. And I commend our audience to check out our conversation with Stanford's Steve Blank for our Annie Marshall series with strategists on how to accelerate the acquisition process. You know, Byron, one of the things that you did extraordinarily well was lay out sort of the staggering magnitude of the national debt and national spending, right? Give us sort of a sense, you know, because inflation is going up and there were concerns that once inflation gets out of control, it has a tendency of being very hard to stuff back in the box. Folks on Wall Street always disdain economists, right? So whenever economists tell them not to worry, they tend to worry more. Where are we on the specifics of the debt? Because people think of it in vague terms, as opposed to the somewhat specific and granular terms you addressed in your briefing.
Well, the point I was trying to make, and look, you know, there's the old saying that what Wall Street had predicted 10 of the last five recessions, and I suppose you could say the same about Wall Street has predicted 10 of the last five of the last actual rate increases or changes in inflation. So, you know, the point that I was just trying to make is there has been a bounce off the lows for interest rates. They're still exceptionally low by historic comparisons. With the stimulus package that the House passed last week, and then, you know, the Senate will probably do so this week, and then the next economic stimulus package, these exceptionally low interest rates could make this very relatively affordable. It's kind of like buying a house. You know, you can buy a lot more house with a lower interest payment on your mortgage. But you know, that this is kind of the key issue. That I don't worry about, but I watch is, are these interest rates now starting to breach levels that had been baked into some of the projections made by Congressional Budget Office is the only one that's really put out a long-term plan. You have to go back a year to see what the Trump White House had put out. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, in the CBO projections, you know, when they look at their deficit estimates, they were looking at a 10-year of around 1.3%. You know, last week we breached 1.5%. Now it's come off a bit again today, but it's just a point that I don't worry so much about the size of the debt as much as I worry about the interest that's paid on that debt. And,
right.
You know, if it's a gigantic if, if that stays low, we can accommodate, we potentially even a bit more for defense spending than kind of the consensus. This is going to be a flat line. But boy, if this thing starts to increase and you really do start to see, you know, parts of the economy overheating and there's wage and cost inflation and rates start to rise, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of doors slam shut.
And as you noted, right, as of January 31, U.S. federal debt held by the public was $21.6 trillion, of which $5 trillion was in T-bills and another $11.2 trillion in Treasury notes, right? I mean, so that sort of frames where we are, which doesn't include intergovernmental holdings, right?
Correct. Correct. And that's basically money that the government owes to itself. It's still a factor. I mean, you still have to pay that interest and make sure that debt's whole because it goes into things like the Social Security Trust Fund. So it's not to dismiss it, but, you know, where the market is really weighing on this is what amount of that total debt, you know, has to be bought and held by the public. The federal government really has no choice in that matter.
Let's talk a little bit about China news flow, right? I mean, obviously, it's a new administration and everybody's attention is focused on policy recommendations. We talked about the Council on Foreign Relations report on Taiwan, which was very, very interesting. And then, of course, the great work that Project 2049, Randy Shriver's organization, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific. Talk to us a little bit about some of the storylines and themes that you see developing that you find most interesting.
Well, they had an event last week that I would commend to people. I think the replay is up on their website. It was just some interesting perspectives on, you know, how China is thinking differently about warfare in the future. Maybe we're lagging a bit in that way. I thought there were some other very interesting comments on, you know, as much as people talk about civil military fusion in China, you know, it's uneven. It's worked in commercial space and quantum, but, you know, they're kind of facing some of the same impediments, not surprisingly, that the U.S. is facing in trying to get smaller technology companies interested in defense. So I just think they made some interesting points. And in my week ahead, I don't have answers to this, but it also kind of keyed up this whole question about what do we know about Chinese defense contractors? And there's not a lot that's in the public domain about what kind of incentives are there? How does their acquisition system work? You know, is it considered a profitable and attractive part for companies or individual entrepreneurs to enter? So I just think there it's another field. I'm sure it's been explored from a classified basis by the intelligence community, but I think in part of this broader competition with China, and again, it kind of goes back to the report that you referenced that I highlighted, the Hudson Institute is going to talk about this week, that, you know, our acquisition system is also very much involved in this competition. And the more we understand about that, I think the more likely it is there could be some change.
We've been talking about this for years. All you need to do is go into the past to actually map a way forward, right? In the past, we were able to develop extraordinary Horizon 3 capabilities and do them in extremely short periods of time, whether it was developing an atom bomb from scratch or after the war, developing the Nautilus, right? I mean, the first nuclear submarine, which was as game-changing as you can get, was something that was built in about 2 years, right? From its authorization to in the water, achieving criticality and then changing the game. I want to point out to our audience that tomorrow we're going to hear from retired Indian Navy Commodore Sujit Samadar, who is the service's former director of plans, and he's now with the Society of Aerospace, Maritime, and Defense Studies in New Delhi, talking to us a little bit about China and the region and how it thinks about warfare and thinks very, very differently about warfare than we think about it, which is a disconnect that it can always be somewhat problematic, trying to understate it a little bit. Byron, talk to us a little bit about corporate research and development. You know, you did a breakdown among some of the leading companies and also tracked a couple of news items. You know, interesting that the CH-53 Sikorsky, Lockheed Martin Sikorsky CH-53K beat, for example, Boeing's CH-47 in its competition for its heavy lift helicopter. Not entirely surprising given that the 53 is already in Israeli service. But talk to us more broadly about the R&D question and what you're finding.
Well, sure. I mean, I think the companies have reported their 2020 results, and they filed 10K forms with the SEC where they talk about research and development spending. Now, the data is really very uneven, and it's hard to generate really good, consistent historic data because, you know, the consolidation, the mergers and acquisitions in the industry, there are, like, Raytheon is a good example. You know, for much of its career, much of its life, it was a multi-industry company, kind of became a pure defense contractor with the Hughes and Texas Instruments acquisitions. And then, you know, just last year with the combination with United Technologies, they're reporting a single research and development number that isn't a pure defense number. It obviously includes research and development for commercial aerospace for Pratt & Whitney and Collins. So, but I think, you know, the two that kind of stand out are Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, because there is a good historic trail you can map out, which is what I did in the report. And, you know, the Northrop increased its R&D as a percent of sales fractionally in 2020 over 2019. For Lockheed Martin, it was down a bit from 2019. Raytheon Technologies, you know, you had to do a little bit of putting the building blocks back together because of the all the change that had happened, but total R&D fell in absolute terms, but it actually increased a bit in terms of sales. That reflected really the I wouldn't say collapse, but the sharp fall off in commercial aerospace. The bottom line to me is, you know, we have a different R&D model in this sector, but it still surprises me a bit that given all the change that's going on in defense, that there's not more emphasis or more focus on research and development spending. And I also recognize that companies can access research and development or new technology through partnerships. They can do it through mergers and acquisition. They can do it through joint venture spending. So this is just one metric, but you know, if I were DOD, I'd be leaning on management's, like, well, why aren't you spending more of your own money on research and development? And I just think it's something that, particularly when you look at where these trends have been over the long term, you know, we've been in a fairly skinny era here in research and development at a time when I think, you know, all that's being talked about in great power competition kind of screams for more research and development spending.
Well, but right, I mean, the entire drive has been increase the share price, so buy back shares, give dividends to investors, right? I mean, that's been the focus. And, yeah, you know, if the Pentagon wants anything developed, spend your, you know, pay us to develop the technology has been, with a few exceptions, right? I mean, there are companies, you know, our sponsor Bell has been rolling the dice, and several of the companies in the industry, including our sponsors, have been doing, you know, taking that model. But as a general rule, I mean, doesn't the Pentagon drive this train at the end of the day?
It does, you know, but the managements do too. I mean, the Northrop chart, I have a separate chart where you break out the spending that they undertook on the F-20 Tiger Shark program, which, you know, in hindsight, didn't work out well. So there are, you know, pluses and minuses to this. And, you know, the shareholders, I think right now, the dominant thing they're looking for these companies is stable profits and stable cash flow that, you know, they can use to buy back stock. And I just think that's not a recipe for success in what I think is going to be a very dynamic market in the 2020s.
Very quickly, we've got about a minute left. Talk to us about the acquisition of L3 Harris's simulation business by CAE for about $1 billion. And then news that broke last week that Leonardo is going to be spinning off DRS. Right now, it's Leonardo DRS, and it's one of our sponsors on the New York Stock Exchange, effectively returning DRS to an independent traded company in the United States with Leonardo to maintain some stake in the business. What do both of these tell you?
That there's a lot of movement going on from a, you know, contractor standpoint. You know, L3 had been talking for a while about divestitures after the merger with L3 and Harris. You know, I think the point is, and these follow, you know, FLIR got bought by Teledyne, Cubic got bought by Veritas and Elliott Management. Perspective got purchased by Veritas as well too. You know, there's been kind of a rush of deals in the first couple of weeks of the new year, and I think that's going to continue. You know, obviously there are two sides to any transaction, but I think this is a period where a lot of companies are going to be looking at what's in our portfolio. You know, where can we create value in an environment where you know, defense markets are probably going to, the top line will be flattish, but there's going to be a lot of movement below that top line. And then, you know, what businesses do we really want to be in? And where can we apply some more firepower? Now, again, I point out, you know, I think it's intriguing this happened with both L3 and then when Northrop Grumman sold its technology business. Both these managements said they're going to put the money, the proceeds from those deals into share buybacks. And I get it, you know, if that's what your shareholders want, but I'm not sure if that's really, you know, going back to the changes that you're seeing in the defense sector, the different competing factors of China, of technology change, you know, is that really going to be the wisest use of the proceeds from these divestitures? You know, when we look back 5 or 10 years from now,
You know, fundamentally, the question is the investment case management makes to investors, right? I mean, if that's all you give them, that's what they expect. If you can give them something new and show that you have a strategic discriminator, then you know that can be a thesis that can work as well. I mean, but interestingly, right? You can't be Textron and develop the Scorpion jet and then nobody buy it, right? You can't be the company that constantly does this unless you're a private company like General Atomics that can afford to take the risk and make those investments at the end of the day that can lead to capability. But again, I mean, the customer has to buy it, right? Yeah. If the customer doesn't buy it.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important part or very important message that not just DoD, but other defense ministries should hear too. It's like, these are businesses. They need paths to show reasonable returns for reasonable risk to their shareholders or their owners. And but the DoD has to be a better customer from that standpoint, and create some lanes where you do open opportunities for new contractors to grow and scale. And not just think, you know, their exit strategy is to get to $25 million and then sell a company to a large prime.
Right. Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure as always. And look forward to having you back on again on Friday on the roundtable. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Thanks, Fago.
And joining us now is my good friend, John Turpak of Air Force Magazine, one of the nation's great aerospace reporters, who spent 2 weeks covering the 3-day aerospace warfare symposium that would have been in Orlando, Florida, had we been able to meet. Instead, this year, it was virtual, and it certainly felt real to you, didn't it, John?
It certainly did. Usually, we discuss the budget at this conference. We didn't have a budget this year, but there was still a lot to talk about and very strong interest. By the way, AFA, despite the fact that there was no budget to talk about, set records for participation, particularly uniform participation. So it was a very great success.
It really was. It's a tremendous event that AFA puts on every year. And it's very, very intimate down in Florida, which is the great thing about it. But this year was virtual. It was bigger. And you're right. This is a transitional part, right? We have a new administration. We don't know who the Air Force Secretary is. We don't know what the budget outlook is. The chief, obviously, a couple of weeks ago made some news on fifth generation minus. You've been covering this conference for a while. What were some of the key messages, whether it was coming from Air Force leaders or industry, that stood out?
Well, of course, General Brown teased this TACAIR study the week before last, and that piqued everybody's interest, and we tried every way we could to try to get some detailed information about what it's going to be. And it seems like what it will be is a look at the Air Force's combat force mix out over the next 20 years, and he wants this done in time to inform the fiscal 23 budget deliberations. And they're going to do this in concert with the Joint Staff and the Office of the Secretary of Defense's CAPE, Cost Analysis and Program Evaluation Shop. So he's looking for what are we going to need in that period of time amongst what we have and what we're in development with and what we may not yet be in development with. So F-22s, F-35s, he specifically said he would like to save the F-35 for the high level, high fight mission and keep it out of the low end missions. But he also said, okay, so what do I use for the low end mission? Now he's looking for something to be a successor to the F-16. So there was a lot to unpack there.
So does this mark the death of Mobile Holmes, the former Air Combat Command commander, who was looking for that counterinsurgency airplane, right? I mean, is this the Air Force's move to say, hey, wait a minute, that's a little too low end for us. But if we had something that was a non-stealthy F-16 replacement, and a lot of folks are talking about the T-7 as it's something that can be modified to carry weapons. Is that what we're basically thinking about?
I think that the propeller-driven airplane, that's kind of off on a sidetrack at this point. And I think the key thing that was left unsaid, it really wasn't made clear how these unmanned systems like the Skyborg, the low-cost attritable system, the Loyal Wingman, how is that going to fit into this plan? It seems like this TAC air plan is mostly about manned aircraft. They didn't talk about how these unmanned systems are going to play. And certainly the Reaper and whatever comes after the Reaper, a stealthy version of the Reaper, they could be a persistent close air support kind of platform. So there's still a lot yet to be figured out about this.
From Lieutenant General Duke Richardson, who is the senior uniformed acquisition advisor at this point, right, acquisition chief, because Will Roper is, Dr. Roper is no longer there. This the idea of the Digital Century series didn't go with Dr. Roper, right, at the end of the day. Talk to us about what General Richardson was saying that you thought was so noteworthy.
Yeah, he was putting everybody on notice. Look, we're going to go with this digital prototyping and pursue this idea of buying an airplane that doesn't have 8,000 flight hours, but maybe will only last 3,000 or 4,000 hours. But he said very distinctly, we have to have the courage to do this because we can't get to the end of one of these short life systems and say, yeah, you know what, let's extend it another 20 years. It's not going to work that way. He was saying, you have to have another one right behind it to take its place or you're going to face disaster. The whole idea of these digital programs is that you refresh your technology far more frequently. And the next one, it could be a variant of what you just built, or it could be something entirely new. And they keep 3 or 4 companies working on them at the same time. So hopefully there will be something right behind. But that was his striking comment. We have to have the courage to do this. You can't go with it and then kind of back away.
That's not necessarily a new notion, right? I mean, I remember a long time ago editorializing that, hey, smaller blocks, more common subsystems, open architectures, you can actually do it because we spend an enormous amount of time remanufacturing old wings and fuselages and all of this other stuff, which is one end. You know what I mean? I mean, it would actually be cheaper if we were buying new airplanes at X intervals instead of keeping around for 50 years and all the costs that go with it. I mean, right, the Air Force is the largest operator of, you know, 707s effectively in the world, KC-135s, and they date from the first generation airliner. What did we learn more about the next generation air dominance aircraft? Mark Kelly, the Air Combat Command commander, has said that, you know, he's looking for them as quickly as possible. There was a lot of talk about the F-35 still being too expensive to operate, which is why some people think that the chief's comments were designed to pressure Lockheed a little bit when sustainment negotiations were going on. You know, so it's a two-part question. What did we learn more about NGAD at this point?
We had a press conference with General Kelly, and at the end of the press conference, he said, gee, you guys didn't ask me about the NGAD, the next generation air dominance airplane. And then he offered his concerns, which we hadn't heard from him before, that China could potentially get those technologies before the United States does, and the U.S. could get beaten to the punch. So clearly he was making a push for the NGAD. some version of which Will Roper told us not long ago has already flown. So I'm not sure what his where his concerns are. Maybe with a new administration, he's concerned that the program won't go forward. But that was striking that he said, look, you know, I'm going to talk about this even if you haven't asked me about it. And he also, he and General Brown both answered the recent media criticism of the F-35. There was a piece in Forbes and also on MSNBC saying the F-35 is a failed program. They both said, no, it's clearly the cornerstone of our Air Force for the foreseeable future. But Kelly did say he has very little confidence that the F-35 operating cost is going to get brought down to the 25,000 by 2025, which, by the way, that's in 2012 base year dollars. The current cost per hour is about $36,000. And Kelly said he's about to go on a tour of all the Air Force F-35 sustainment enterprise to see what can be done to get that cost under control.
But one of the problems the challenge to General Brown's great commentary with Dave Berger, the commandant of the Marine Corps that ran in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago, one airman pointed out that, look, I mean, one of the reasons that the Air Force suffers from readiness and a high cost of readiness is that it tends to vest long-term support and sustainment for its platforms through its prime contractors. Effectively, it doesn't compete those maintenance packages, and obviously every one of the prime contractors likes that. Do we need a different readiness model in the Air Force? I mean, you know, I think that General Kelly mentioned that that might need to change to inject more competition into the system.
I fully expect that there are going to be moves in that direction. One of the reasons I'm convinced that the Air Force brought in the F-15EX, or rather the Department of Defense brought it in and directed the Air Force to buy it, was to give Lockheed some competition and say, look, you know, we can spend our money in different ways. It doesn't all have to be F-35. So, yes, I would agree that that's certainly part of what you're hearing with the open mission systems and open architecture. Is we don't want to be beholden to anybody. We want to be able to go to somebody else and say, maintain this airplane for us. The first guy wasn't doing a good enough job.
Dr. Roper also talked about NGAD being sort of competition for the F-35 at the end of the day. It's a big achievement to put an airplane together in 1 year, but it's a little bit of an easier achievement if you already have the engine in the F-135, the Pratt & Whitney engine that powers the F-35 fighter, that you have a great combat system, which is the front end of the F-35, which nobody particularly complains about. It's really game-changing, and a lot of the other subsystems. And I think there's a sense that this NGAD is a twin engine, larger, more fuel tanks, bigger payload capability to range out ahead to perform the air dominance mission. Is this airplane maybe less of a mystery than some people want to imagine it being?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that it's not one airplane. I asked General Brown about this during this conference. I said, look, the last three heads of Air Combat Command have said, we have two very different requirements here in terms of range. We have the European model where, you know, the range of an F-35 is just fine. And we also have the Indo-Pacific model where you need a lot more gas to get where you're going. So either NGAD is going to be a couple of variants, a short range and a long range variants, or maybe there are two different airplanes that are going forward into competition. I suspect that it's going to be the latter. And I also think that it's not impossible that NGAD for the Pacific could be something that looks more like a B-21 than it does an F-35.
Right. Something that can carry a multiplicity of air launch systems, each one of which carries a multiplicity of weapons on them.
Exactly. I mean, I think the Air Force would be missing a beat if they failed to use something like the B-21 to launch. We've already seen these long shot concepts where it's a small UAV that carries air-to-air missiles of its own and flies out ahead of the rest of the force. So I think that there's going to be a lot of different approaches to the kill chain in the near future.
It reminds me of a dinner I had a long time ago with John Jumper when he was chief, and was talking about, hey, you know what? If actually maybe in the future, the best air-to-air airplane is something the size of a 737 that just carries a ton of weapons, has got the sensors, and allows me to reach out and touch somebody at range with a whole bunch of different packages. And it kind of prescient, right? I mean, even though it was, you know, that conversation was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first time we've talked about a missileer. I think at this point now we have the confluence of the stealth technology, the artificial intelligence, the machine learning, the network of sensors that could make it work.
We were supposed to hear this year for Air Force 2.0. What did the chief tell you when you asked him about where the status of Air Force 2.0?
Yeah, I really expected the Air Force to set us up for their second version of the force we need, which they came out with 2 years ago. This is the future force unconstrained by budgets. This is what the Air Force needs to do business. And when I asked the chief about force we need 2.0, he said he hadn't been briefed on it yet. It's due this month.
All right. Well, later this month, John, we'll have you back on and you can let us know what the plan says. Absolute pleasure having you on as always. Thanks very much. Terrific work as usual with you and the AFA team, and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.